Hi, this is Lesbian Nation. Today I had a very lucky accident. Instead of breaking my leg, I ran into Rita Mae Brown and Blanche Boyd, two women who have just published books. Yours is Ruby Fruit Jungle, and yours is called Nerves. That is, Rita Mae did Ruby Fruit Jungle, Blanche did Nerves. And I ran into them at the firehouse and decided to haul them up here for an interview. So we're at the studio tonight. Let's see, how long have you been working on that book? Because I remember you talking about it for a while, sort of calling it The Adventures of a Young Knight.
Well, I think once I sat down to write it, it took about 6 months, you know, with editing and rewriting. But the queen of diligent labor is truly Blanche.
7 years it took me, but that's off and on. So the first time I finished it was after 3 years, and the second time I finished it was after four. Then I decided I couldn't finish it. I don't know how much writing time I really put in.
Well, what's it about? I have to confess that I've read Ruby Fruit Jungle, but I haven't read Nerves yet.
Well, my relationship to the work is pretty internal, but somebody said to me it was a book about women who have no access to or understanding of the women's movement, and I think that's somewhat true. It's about growing up in the South. It's set in 1962, but it doesn't matter. There's very little external to date the book. It's about a kid who's 14, and her relationships with other women in her family, her aunt, her mother, a friend of her mother's. And it's set in one summer. And it's the things that happened to them.
What part of the South?
Charleston, South Carolina.
A place I've never been to. I guess I have to find out about it from reading the book.
It's a nice place to visit.
Like New York.
I wouldn't want to grow up there.
Did you?
Yeah.
Why don't you tell something about what yours is about?
Oh, mine's about a trashy dyke. I don't know what else to say about it.
Anybody like you?
It's about a lesbian Huck Finn.
Blanche has been really telling me that it's truly a lesbian Huckleberry Finn. I would never say if it was like me or not. I want to live, Martha.
I can't even tell anymore. I mean, people say, is this autobiographical? And I think, sometimes I say yes and sometimes I don't. I have no idea.
Getting separated from you somehow in the writing?
I have a hard time remembering the real events. I know that the things in the book didn't happen, but it doesn't make any difference. I feel like the mother in the book goes crazy. People have begun to like treat me as if I'm a person who has a crazy mother. There's nothing crazy about my real mother. But I've made myself another mother in the book. I also made myself another adolescence, which was a smart move.
Yeah, I think I'd like to get rid of mine, you know.
It's a great exorcism.
You were saying something as we came into the studio about the problem of being Southern up north.
Oh.
And the Southern writer syndrome or something.
Yeah, it's a curious problem that I think it affects anyone. Regional prejudice, the South just gets it stronger than anyone else. And when I first came to New York, I was a refugee from the land of Magnolian prejudice. And I think I was 19 and 20 at the time. And whenever I opened my mouth, I was severely censored. And my accent was much thicker then, so I set about systematically trying to destroy my linguistic heritage. And in fact, it is a linguistic heritage. It's like any subgroup that tries to talk television talk. And people all over the country are losing the kind of brilliant, crystallized metaphors they had that came from their ethnic group or their subculture. And the South is a land rich in verbal usage. And even now, when I'm older and have a little bit more substance than I did when I was young. Not that I'm brighter or anything like that, but people treat you better as you get older. I mean, youth oppression is a very real thing. Even now, if a trace of an accent creeps in, and I still have one, I get people who mock me. They mock your speech, like, you must be from the South, y'all. You know, they say ridiculous things like that. Or they assume you're stupid, or what Blanche and I were talking about earlier, which is so infuriating, is they begin to ask you questions about race, which, as you noted, Martha, is in itself racist. But they find nothing at all outrageous in grilling you about race relations in the South and not taking too much time to look in their own backyard, which is pretty dirty.
Yeah. Also, it's like you're from a foreign country. You know, they say, they think Southerners wear guns.
Wear guns?
Well, yeah. A friend of mine from England was going to go to the South, and she thought it was like, they think they're going to get shot like an Easy Rider, you know? And they might.
They might get shot if they go down there, or?
Well, I think the South is more dangerous than a lot of people do, although that's kind of irrelevant.
I mean, I don't know. You know, I always figured New York is just as dangerous as anywhere else.
It is, but
it's just a different kind.
Yeah, it's a different kind of thing.
Well, there are still vestiges of community down there, and if you flagrantly disobey the internal laws of the community, you're going to pay for it.
I get it. And up here, there isn't community. What you get shot for is just when they want to rip you off, or randomly, like somebody loses his temper in Grand Central Station.
It's very different. If something happens to you down there, it has to do with...
You did something to provoke it.
Yeah. It in some way involves a moral issue. And the people who get hurt may not perceive that it's moral. But in New York, there's no morality involved. You're a victim.
Just pure and simple violence.
Yeah. I mean, except, of course, for sex crimes.
Yeah.
Which isn't quite random then.
I mean, it's sort of random in the sense of any woman will do for a sex crime, but it definitely has to be a woman.
Yeah. We got a TV when I was in the fourth grade, and I was horrified to find out that we didn't talk like other people. And because it was TV, I thought that they were normal and I wasn't. So I worked real hard to talk like TV. Mm-hmm. Then when I was 18, I left, and I could get over everything but saying y'all, which I couldn't get over. And people still treated me like I was stupid because I was a woman, which is when I discovered the whole problem wasn't that I was Southern. And after about a year, I just decided I didn't care, you know. Anybody who thought I was stupid because of my accent because I was a woman was making a mistake. And it was their loss.
Blanche, maybe that's why we write books, because they wouldn't let us open our mouths.
It's funny, I started picking up the usage of y'all, mostly because there isn't any, you're plural in standard English.
It's a functional
word.
Yeah.
But I remember when I went to City College trying to talk like the professors for a while, you know, trying to lose the nasal Brooklyn kind of accent. I'm sure I haven't, because anytime I go out of New York City and open my mouth, everybody says, oh, Brooklyn. So there it is.
Yeah, you clip off your S and E's. Like, you don't say because. You say it. Say it. Say the word.
Because.
Right. It's different. It's distinctive. I want to ask Blanche a question, which is, we published with a feminist, a brand new feminist press, and I feel like you have a greater knowledge of the history of that company, how it started and why it started, and I wish you would tell people about that, because it really is, it's very significant that we published with Daughters and not, say, with Random House.
Yeah, I don't know really that much about, like, the history of it. I know the people who are doing it fairly well, and I know what my feelings are about publishing with that company. And
well, how long, as far as I know, these are the first, it's just come out with five books, and these are the first books it's published.
These are, like one of the authors said, these are the first books that were ever produced, edited, written, composed, and trucked by women.
And unloaded by women, too.
Trucked. How's the distribution system, by the way? Where can our readers get, the listening audience, get the books?
At Labrys, which is down on 7th Avenue and where?
33 Barrow Street.
33 yeah. Barrow, right. I think they have all of the copies there. There's Nerves by Blanche, Ruby for Jungle by myself, The Cook and the Carpenter by June Arnold, Early Losses by Pat Birch, and a really unusual one called The Treasure by, how do you say her name, Blanche?
I think Lagerlöf.
Selma Lagerlöf, a Nobel Prize winner who died quite a few years ago, a Swedish woman.
And a feminist.
Right. Yeah. And they're all down there. And the thing about Daughters that's remarkable is that they have, the two people who started it, Park Bowman and June Arnold, have a kind of literate background. And found, through their own experiences and experiences of many of their friends who are also writers, that women could not get published because the existing presses, almost said prejudices, it's the same damn thing, don't really want to know about women's lives. They only select out the kind of women's lives that meet their oppressed version of what women should be, you know? I mean, think of the novels that the big presses publish done by women. Most of them are very self-destructive characters, you know?
Yeah.
Women with no women's consciousness. The writer has no feminist consciousness. And that's what the
They're all losers, basically.
Sure.
As a matter of fact, I had an interview earlier in September with Marge Piercy, who wrote a book where there's a woman who comes up a winner and who happens to be a lesbian. And that book was trashed, really trashed, by the New York Times, Time Magazine, and Ms. Magazine.
That's interesting. I haven't read that. I wonder what they'll do with Ruby Fruit, because Molly is anything but a loser.
Well, Gloria Steinem gave you a blurb, I saw.
Yeah, she wrote a nice thing about it.
So I suspect they'll probably plug it.
I don't know. I mean, obviously, I hope so. But it's a very confusing situation to be in to try to show the lives of women who are fighting, who are aggressive, and to find, I expect men to be total pigs about it. I don't want them to be, but I expect them to be, you know. But when a woman has a reaction like that, it really leaves you flat, you know. When a woman reacts against a strong character.
Oh, but you see, the reviews of Marge's book in all of those three periodicals I mentioned were done by women.
I understand it completely.
They pick out the women to review the books.
It's like you get the token lady to do your hatchet job on the women's movement. Hell, that's been going on since the beginning. Mm-hmm.
There's also been a certain assumption that women's lives and women's problems belong to sort of the Ladies' Home Journal, aren't the material that serious art is made from. And I know that, like, an earlier version of my book, when it got, one of the rejection letters said, who's interested in the problems of a bunch of neurotic women? And all I could think at that time was, I am, you know, and I really am. That editor, I think, has gone around the bend. He's a little more interested in neurosis than he was.
What's so infuriating is the character of Under the Volcano by Lowry. I mean, you know, well, how more self-destructive can a character get? But because it's a man, it's therefore interesting. You know, it's the old prejudice rap coming down again.
Well, it depends on the type of neurosis. Like, people will read now, you know, in spite of the women's movement, or almost irrelevant to it, about Janis Joplin. Because, wow, you know, she shot dope, and wow, she killed herself, and that was the way it should be. Or maybe even a better case in point, since Janis had a pretty wild time before she killed herself. Marilyn Monroe. I mean, they'll pick over her bones like a bunch of vultures, and I can think of one vulture in particular.
I'm glad you brought that up. I really want to speak directly to Marilyn Monroe, which is, I think, the nostalgia boom in the resurrection of Marilyn and wedgies and all the disgusting things that are coming back, the 50s and the 40s, is an absolutely direct response to women's liberation. I mean, they can no longer create a sex symbol. People have too much consciousness. Raquel Welch attempts to be a sex symbol, and no man who pretends to sensitivity can take her seriously, right? She's mocked at. I happen not to think she's funny. I think the woman's paying a lot for what she's doing. But we no longer live in an age where we can have a woman sex symbol. So they dig up Marilyn because she's safe, because she can't fight back, she's dead, and because she was the crystallization of every crummy thing that's ever happened to a woman. And I think it's deliberate.
As I couldn't agree with you more. And the wedgies, I think, are almost a deliberate attempt to bring back that sort of crippling thing that we went through with spike heels.
Yeah.
Except that the interesting thing about them is at least you could stab somebody with a spike heel. You can't do a damn thing with a wedgie but break your own ankle.
Right. It's artistically, it works in another fashion. For instance, there's a great vogue for Sylvia Plath now. Let's just leave her technical work aside, because technically I think she's a good poet. But there's a whole generation of young women poets now who are attempting to what I call imitate the oven variety of poetry. And it's again, it's the woman as a loser, the woman as a person who defeats herself. And it's terribly damaging to pick these people up as heroes. It's not damaging to single out their lives as a lesson, because they are lessons to all of us. But to hold them up as heroes is a mistake. Because while they were living, there were also women who lived and fought, who did not take their lives, who did not take dope, who did not drown themselves in a sea of scotch, who fought, but who didn't perhaps catch the eye of the media, or who didn't write books, who perhaps were black or Asian American or poor white trash, and so they're lost. And they really are heroes.
I think a lot of the response to Sylvia Plath is people see her as a symbol of some side of them, a side of themselves they can't act out. and that she is a real symbol, and that poetry after her changed. But, I mean, I see her mostly as an incredible victim of what happens, what can happen to very talented women with no peer group. I mean, I think that she was a really isolated person and didn't have, I mean, she was married to another poet who was making it big. Technically, she's real good. I think that she just had no sense of there being other people who were in the same kind of situation she was. And I think that's happened to a lot of women.
I think an awful lot of women who were creative, who were married to men who were into the arts, got drowned under the weight of those men. Because most writers, not all but most, I think, and most artists cannot stand to live in close proximity to somebody in the same field. Maybe it's as we sort of outgrow the real capitalist competitive thing that's been laid on us, it'll be possible for that to change. But I've associated with a lot of women writers in New York, and I find that that's the case, you know, not just with male poets like What's-His-Name, who was married to Sylvia Plath.
Isn't yeah, let's groovy? Not even give him credit. Let's yeah. not even
What's
give
his
him
name
some,
who was married yeah. to Sylvia Plath, her ex-husband. But I find this is really true with a lot of women writers here and who are very much into, you know, say, verbally knifing each other at literary parties,
it's
worrying about who's
art.
Got... Sure.
It really is.
I think it's just silliness.
It's a lot of both. Yeah. It's the whole idea. I'm beginning to think that the motto for New York is, "Dear God, if I succeed, may my best friend fail." Mm. You know, and I've been at the in those kind of situations where the people are they're hustling you all the time. They're hustling you, and you have to fight for airtime. You know, you have to fight to even get a word in edgewise, and they're constantly repping for themselves. I'm a this writer. I'm a that writer. So and so said I was this and that. And boy, it's boring. You know, I want to sit down with a person, not an advertisement.
About, let's get back to Daughters Incorporated, because this sounds like, in some ways, a way out of this. Like, if women aren't competing for the approval of Random House, or to get published in, say, Cosmopolitan, or to be one of the 6,000 manuscripts that come in every day to Ms. Magazine and be the one that gets selected out of that very narrow market, it sounds like this begins to be an alternative now.
I'm sure that it's an alternative, but I would just like to remove Ms. from connection with Random House in those places, because I do think it's a different phenomenon.
I think it's a different phenomenon, but what I see happening is, and what I know happening there, is that thousands of manuscripts are coming in all the time from women who have no other place to go, who are writing stuff
right.
that will not be accepted elsewhere. And therefore, you know, Ms. is in a situation where they can only select a very small amount of what comes in.
Daughters is in that situation, too. I mean, to do anything like that, you have to make selections, you have to make choices, and those choices are going to be painful to somebody or other. And that's inevitable.
Yeah, but there are more outlets, say, for a larger
yeah,
number of
a
men's
lot
manuscripts.
More. We need a lot more. I mean, MS serves a function that I think that they're overloaded. I mean, they have a lot more stuff coming.
And obviously, Daughters is going to be overloaded with.
Oh, it already is.
It already is.
With a lot of good stuff that has to be turned down on account of there's no facilities to print all of that.
Yeah, one of the basic things for me that a place like Daughters solves is that my training as a writer. It was fairly classical, you know. I went to graduate school and all that stuff. And for me, feminism and art made a big split. Once I got into the women's movement, I had a certain kind of analysis that made the world make sense. But artistically, my sense of things was pretty complex. And I couldn't put those two sides of my life together at all. My feminist analysis seemed simplistic in terms of what I was trying to do in art. On the other hand, my artist's worldview seemed pretty irrelevant to what I could figure out politically. So when I met the women at Daughters, I felt like, first of all, here were very serious women working on the same question that I was working on, who had figured out things that I hadn't about it. And I still have problems putting those two things together, but Daughters really solves a lot of that for me. I feel like the books on the list are serious art and meet all my criteria about that, and yet I don't feel like I've been sold out or bought or that I'm being patronized the way I would feel with a big trade publisher.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I've heard a lot of complaints from women about the kind of contracts they get and the kind of treatment they get.
Yeah, I want to speak to you thing about that. You felt the split between feminism and art, and it's a tremendous creating is a tremendous tension. It takes a lot out of you. It's a very draining activity, and I think one of the reasons, perhaps not for you, but for so many other women that I know that are artists, why they felt the conflict between feminism and art was that in the beginning of the movement, we hadn't been used to political organizing. Most of us were physically quite young. We were in our late teens mm-hmm. and early 20s when the movement started, and I know Martha and I were, what, 21 when we met at Student Homophile League when we started.
Something like that, yeah.
We were much younger, and we thought everybody had to be doing exactly what we were doing, and that to be political meant that everybody had to be organizing, you know, making phone calls, talking to people, trying to
marching
do child
down the streets.
Right, and it's true. You do have to do those things, but they have to be coordinated, and we weren't coordinated. And the people who had that in them to create art got torn, because if they didn't do the organizing things, they were trashed. And there was a lot of class confusion, and the downwardly mobile women who come from middle class backgrounds rejected art because they associated it with their class. Now, I didn't come from that background. I come from a real lower class background. And to me, art was a tremendous liberating force. It was a way to fight back. It was a way to give my feminism flesh and blood in a way that mere rhetoric couldn't do. Although I'm not saying I wasn't rhetorical in writing political articles, because I've continued to do that and organize. But it was much easier for me to synthesize feminism and art than I believe it was for middle-class women, where they still associate art with negative values in their past.
That's interesting. For me, whenever I've been in touch with it, art has always been a way of making myself feel good, you know, in a way that a good meal or sex does, but somewhat different.
Well, I hope so, Martha.
A part of the problem I had, though, at that same period was feeling like being a revolutionary meant, you know, you had to suffer. And therefore, art was suspicious because it felt good and it looked good and it made you feel good inside. It made you feel in touch with something that you couldn't find reading a copy of Pravda, either in Russian or translation.
Hey, Martha, that's why so many women were anti-lesbian in the beginning, because it made them feel good and that made them feel suspicious.
I had a different development. Like, I mean, writing's what I do, and I don't think about it in terms of whether it makes me feel good or bad. It's just what I do. And sometimes it makes me feel perfectly awful, in fact, and sometimes I get real high. It's my most intense experience, is how I would put it, and my most addictive. But when I got to feminism, I thought, oh, here's what I was trying to do, because, I mean, it brought something together for me. I never have been much of a political thinker. Feminism brought something basic together for me. I think if the early version of my book had a thesis or a theme or a meaning, it was everything is too complicated to understand. That was my point.
And now you have a way of understanding it.
Now I have a way of understanding what it was I was trying to do instinctively. It doesn't change that I have to work instinctively. One thing that's certainly true is I don't write happy books, you know. I think of my book as like writing myself an adolescence I could bear and a monument to the casualties.
You working on any other books these days?
I have a book of political essays that'll be coming out, I think, in March maybe, by a woman's press in Iowa. We're not sure if we're going to call it Sally Forth or Running Battles. And I'm working on my second novel, which is called In Her Day, and I know that Blanche is working on her second novel, too.
It's called Sleep, but I'll probably change the title.
I think somebody used something like that. No, was Call It
call
Sleep.
It Sleep.
Yeah.
I'm beginning to think that finding the right title is harder than writing the book.
I would disagree with that. My title came to me long before the book did. Anyway, we're going to have to get off now, but before that happens, I've got two announcements to make. One of them is that the city has decided to turn over temporarily the Women's Center, the firehouse on 20th Street, to the Women's Center group, or at least not to take it away and sort of leave it for the next administration to either give it to the Women's Center or take it away. So I want to thank all of the people who sent in telegrams expressing their feelings on the matter. Also, candidate Beam has expressed his support for the work that the Women's Center group is doing and how the group should be entitled to keep the firehouse. The other candidates have said they want to study the problem before they make any statements. And I'm sure those of you who are for the Women's Center group and those of you who are against can send in your letters and telegrams to those candidates urging them to either take it or give it away as you so desire. Another matter came to my attention this morning while I was running around the track at 6th Street and FDR Drive. Yes, I sometimes do that besides sit here and shoot my mouth off. And that is that there is a building next to the track which has a pit for jumping and you can run around and play football and pole vault and do a lot of things. There's a building there where you can take showers, and the men's shower room is open and in use, but the women's shower room has been boarded up for 10 years. And so there I was after running about a mile and a half and all sweaty, and I couldn't take a shower. And I think that's a crime. And I think that if you were into writing your candidates or the mayor or the board of estimate, we should advise them that this is definitely sex discrimination. And we want the showers open. And if any of you want to join me next Sunday morning at 9 a.m., I'll be running around the track again. And if we get enough women out there, then these candidates will just have to see that it's absolutely necessary to open up the showers for us, and maybe they can throw in a few towels.
Great, Martha.
A couple other quick announcements. The Lesbian Feminist Liberation is having a dance this coming Friday night at the Firehouse. That's 99 Worcester Street. There is also a meeting on Sunday afternoon where there'll be a panel discussion by women transvestites. And on Monday night, for those of you who want to work for LFL, there's a regular business meeting. I just got a note from the New Jersey Gay Switchboard and Information Center, which is currently operating from these telephones, 609-921-2565 and 609-883-5207. So if you're having any problem in living out in New Jersey, that's the Gay Switchboard number, and they say they hope to have a phone in the 201 area in the near future. Also, the Gay Women's Alternative, which is an over 30 group, is going to be meeting on November 1st, Thursday night. There's a $3 donation requested. There's going to be wine and cheese and a talk about The Healthy Lesbian by Barbara Giddings and Dr. George Weinberg. For those lesbians who are interested in a self-expression theater group, it's going to be meeting Thursday from 6 to 8 p.m., run by two women from the It's All Right to Be Women theater group. If you're interested, write to me at WBAI, and I'll put you in touch with. This is Martha Shelley for Lesbian Nation. Good night.